idyllic girl wears white gossamer. It's like she, every girl that's supposed to be like the dream girl in the MTV spots has on like some kind of white dress that floats or behind her. It's like she becomes an angel. And I think that that's what we did, and I think that's what Steven did. I think that you start projecting this angel image of, you know, gossamer onto it. Ron Howard. Well, how Ron Howard came to be is that one of the things that happened as the script progressed is that it moved away from being a science fiction story to being a great character piece. That was something that we were working on with Tom Benedict. I mean, we wanted these characters to really come alive. We wanted to take a chance in making a film that starred primarily an older cast. But we wanted them to be people we wanted them to be people that all of us know but don't see that way. I mean, I think one of the things that strikes you, unless you're around older people all the time, which a lot of us aren't, is that our older people have the same set of desires that young people do. It's just that I don't think that we walk around every day and see our grandparents having the same desires as that we do. So that was something we were trying to accomplish in the movie. And with that being a goal, and with humor being a goal, and with the action being a goal, we needed somebody who was very versatile at being able to pull off all of those things. I mean, if we had wanted just strictly to pull off the action, I don't know that Ron would have been totally necessary, because for as great as the action is, there's probably other guys that can do action, but I don't know anybody else that is as versatile as Ron in delivering on all those levels, so that you get humor and you get heart, you get character development. He's not afraid to go into areas that somebody else may find slightly corny. He's not afraid to show emotion on the screen. And he understood the material, and I think that was very important. I think that if it, in working on this project, if at any time you said to yourself, well, if somebody like this came down, I would scream bloody murder and run the other way, you don't get the thrust of what we're trying to do. I mean, not that this is a message film, it's not, but I think it was important that all of us that were working on it really did feel, wouldn't this be pretty neat if this happened to us? Ron and I said we don't want it to happen quite this year. You know, a couple of years would be all right, you know, see the kids off to college. But, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing if we came down. We didn't choose to define when you would return, by the way, because we don't want to. I mean, we didn't want to know when we'd be coming back, so we didn't tell you when we'd be coming back. You meaning the audience.
Might get a generation back into the theaters that's not been going to movies for a while this way?
I don't know. That would be very nice. I think that there's probably a whole generation out there that doesn't go to the theater that may want to. Maybe there's not things that they see. As I said earlier, this is a real bold decision to make a movie that stars so many veteran actors when you can't target your market. Couldn't then, and you really can't now. This is just something that we think that we did a very good job on. We think it's very entertaining. We don't have a problem with the cast's age. We find that it moves real well. And so hopefully people will like it of all ages. I mean, we didn't say, well, this will hit a broad audience, but that's what we hope will happen.
Will we see a music video with Don Amici breakdancing?
You know what? You will. Did you know that already?
No, I was just...
interview with someone in Winnipeg the other day. It was quite a lengthy one. I was supposed to be on... it was a radio interview, and it was supposed to go all around on that. I've never been out in your part of the country. Toronto I have, Montreal and Quebec. Toronto is one of my favorite cities in the world. God, what a gorgeous, gorgeous city. Mercy. My.
Well, I can remember during the Trading Places junket, we asked you, did you ever think you'd live to see a day when you'd use that particular type of language in a movie? And
no, I never did. I never thought I would.
And now, did you ever think you'd live long enough to be doing a breakdance sequence?
No, for sure. For sure. I never dreamed that.
It's going to be part of that in a music video. They're going to run on the MTV.
Oh, are they really?
Yes. So apparently you're going to reach another generation as well.
They're an odd generation, though. You should have seen that nightclub. We filmed it in a nightclub that is a breakdance place. That's what it is in Tampa. We were over in Tampa and did it. You can't believe these people that were in this place. My goodness sake, what strange people they were. One assistant cameraman, when we went to lunch, nice man, good family man, and a hard worker, just a genuine person. As a matter of fact, show you the kind of guy he was when it was over. He had a trailer, and he brought his three children, and he and his wife and the three children took a trip all up the East Coast, up into Canada, all around, just to give the children a new experience. Just the kind of guy he was. Well, by lunch, he'd already had four women that had dropped notes with their address and phone numbers. And, you know, oh, this was a day, honestly. And he wasn't one of the good-looking ones. So what the good-looking ones got, I don't know. My.
How much of the dancing did you do yourself?
I did most of, practically all that you saw.
You were right.
Pardon me. No, no, I didn't. No.
What was the appeal of this group for you? What did you like about this group?
I thought the... I'll go back. I love the script, and I don't really believe that a performer or anyone else can read a script and predict the success or the failure of a picture, and I don't believe that it's possible to predict exactly what the character is going to be, nor what his influence in the picture is going to be, nor exactly what the relationship is going to be between all those things. I think this is like a stage play. I believe all those things were meant to be put on a stage, and motion pictures were meant to be put before a motion picture camera. And what comes out is an altogether different thing than what a person reads. I don't believe anybody can do that. When I was young, I thought you could. When I got to be older, I knew that you couldn't possibly do that. So my idea is I loved reading it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I had that feeling that... in my knowledge that I couldn't predict, but I thought it had a chance of making a good motion picture. And I don't think I'm disappointed at all. The relationships between all the people, I couldn't predict them because I didn't know the people. I didn't know Wilfred Brimley. I never met him. I never met Brian Dennehy. I knew Hume and Jessica, but I didn't know them well at all. I never had worked with Maureen. I only knew Maureen to meet her, you know, so I knew hardly anyone in the picture. I knew very little about Ron. I knew very little about Richard Zanuck. So I don't really know what I expected. I just went in hoping that it would be good and that I could be decent in what I was going to do. That's about it.
Succeeded. We were talking earlier about whether or not a generation of viewers would come into the theater, people who have maybe stopped going to movies for some years, if they might not come back to this.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that they chose this picture, Lily and Richard Zanuck. I believe that was a big influencing factor, that you can get to those people. Now, there have been... what did I read lately? Pictures that do appeal to them, they do go to see. People over, I believe they called over 45. Yes, Golden Pond did, as a prime example of what I'm talking about. Because now, I don't know whether you people, do you know what percentage of pictures made are R pictures? It's over 50%.
Well, it's mostly PG-13. Well, okay, no, PG-13 and R is not much of a difference.
No,
anymore.
R. These are R. Over 50% are R pictures. And there's a reason for that. Demographics dictate that. Between 13 and 21 are the biggest money spenders in the motion picture industry. The biggest part of the income comes from that group, 13 to 21. So this is the reason why you get so many pictures like that. You know, it's a greed industry at the present time. You have a shot of making a picture for $1 million or $2 million and making $2 or $3 or $4 million out of it. Fine, you go home with it, that kind of thing. And I would rather think that the older generation has been a little bit neglected. And I think this was a deep consideration in Lily and Richard's minds when they had this picture made.
In your mind, then, does this bode well for the future of films appealing to an older age group?
I think it'll depend on what the picture does. If it'll do business, I don't know.
Looking at the other direction, since Trading Places, for example, have you found that people... younger people who perhaps didn't recognize you as quickly before or recognizing you in public? Have you found you've got a whole new generation of fans?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have a whole big group. Young people did come up to me, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 20-year-olds, yes. Not by droves, by any manner of means, but here and there, yes, this happened, and it was pleasing, and they seemed to understand what the picture was all about, you know, and know what it was all about, and that this was nice. It was very nice. As a matter of fact, Trading Places didn't generate very much for me. This is the first offer that I had, really, after Trading Places, was this picture. And that I finished that, I believe, a year ago in March. There was about... And I started this in August, so it's almost a year and a half in which I had no offers of any kind.
Well, speaking of spanning generations, you've got Tyrone Power Jr. in the cast there, as opposed to his father back at Fox in older days. What were your feelings? Must have been an odd sort of timelessness.
Well, I enjoyed meeting him. It was a great, nice experience for me. His father was the only close, even remotely close friend I had in the motion picture industry. And there's very much of his dad in him, an awful, awful lot. He looks very, very much like him. He's a bigger man, taller man, broader. But same gentleness, same shyness that his dad had. Whether what kind of a performer he is, I don't know. You know, he didn't have very much opportunity in this picture, but I liked what I saw in him. He was lovely to be around. I didn't talk to him a great deal because he's shy, and he isn't free in his conversation at all. Charming boy, charming man.
How many takes did you have to do with all the pool sequences?
How many takes?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. There were some where we'd have to continue to keep drying off, is how I remember them. I would guess 4 to 5 would be about as many as we would do. That was about as high as it would go.
Did you all get to contribute what you thought you would do best on this?
Yes. He gave everyone pretty much free rein, Ron did, to do what you thought you could do, you know. Wilford could only do the one thing, the big splash and all that. Hume is a good swimmer. And he
pretty good diver.
Yes, very much so, very much so. He looked very graceful, I thought, very graceful. He's a nice human being. He's a well-read man, by the way, Hume Cronin. There's a lot more dimension to him than the average performer, Hume. And Jessica, of course. Didn't you love her in the picture?
No.
God, she is so good. Phew. My.
For me, the most touching part of the movie was the fact that it shows older people as still people. So often we are inclined to forget that. Is that one of the things that appeals to you?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Because they are still real. Now, of course, you find many people that have given it up, you know, just said, and many of them I can't blame, you know. If you've worked hard all your life, let's say you were a laboring man, you know, by the time you got to be 55, you're dead, you're beat. And I can understand that in people, you know, but then you'll find people that quit when they're, well, like this man that owns his horse, Spend the Buck. He retired at 38. And there are a number of people in the world that I have known of, in America especially, where they get $10 million, no matter what age they are, they say, that's it. They walk away. Well, I can't think that's a very interesting life for those people from that time on. And there are other people that, well, God, when you stop and think, Churchill was a failure until he was 72 or 73 years old, and nothing he did was a success. Bismarck put together Germany when he was 72. Adenauer was over 70 when he took over Germany. If it hadn't been for him, you wouldn't have a Germany that's anything like the Germany it is today, in my opinion. Because he was, and there was a reason for that, I thought, he was really a king to those people, and I think they still are people that need to be led, totally need to be led, and he was that figure, and he brought them to where they are today. So there are many that look at Schweitzer, 90 years old, 91 or 92 years old, still making a contribution to his fellow man. So there are a lot of people that stay with it. Armand Hammer, look at what he's doing, the head of Occidental today, you know, still trying to make deals with Russia, 86 years old, making contributions to the art world, you know, is all interested in that Shroud of Turin, you know. going, all those kind of things. So there are variations in old people, the same as there are when they're in their 30s or when they're in their 20s, I believe. I believe that. And this, I think, is what this picture showed. Because there in the community, you saw many that had totally given up. Totally given up when we were working. You know, we were exposed to them all the time. And others, we had one man in the pictures over 100 years old. He made that trek down to the pool. Made it at 100 years old. So the discrepancies, I believe, are not very much different than they are in other people. I don't have any plans. I just hope to God I can be active. And it doesn't make any difference whether it's in this business or any other business. I read a great deal. I've been in so many other businesses in my life, you know, tried so many different things that I still have a lot of interest. Thoroughbreds I still own. I've fooled with them for years and years. I owned my first one in 1938, so I've been at it that long at that phase of the game. You know, I've been in the stock market. I've been in the grain trading market, commodity markets. I've been in everything that you can almost think about. I've drilled oil wells. I mean, actually been there to put together the deals and do all that kind of thing. So there's many, many things I've done. Invented the telephone, that's right.
I'm wondering if you...
Went down to hell and...
Yes, heaven can wait.
You must have friends and have visited friends out at the Motion Picture Country Home. I've been out there on a number of occasions. And a couple of things about that. One, was it ever considered as a possible location for...
No, not to my knowledge.
Uh-huh. Would have been an interesting idea.
Yes, but you wouldn't have gotten the cross-section that you get here, because that's only one kind of people. You know, these are motion picture people. And when we went to St. Petersburg, well, you had a diversity of people. You know, they come from all over there. Your part, there are a lot of Canadians down there, a great deal of Canadians down there. Yes, supposedly. That's right. No, it didn't, because I've never believed in it. I've never ever heard of it. I've heard of people that are still active in every way in their 80s and still producing many, many things, but I don't think it was a rejuvenation. I think it was a constant stream for them. I don't think they ever got out of the mainstream. They just kept at it. Edison was still doing the things that he was doing. I don't think Einstein ever slowed down. You know, there were many of these people that remained contributors. You know, they just kept doing it. But the rejuvenation, this didn't mean anything to me. Fountain of Youth is, I'll leave that to the Italians. They were the ones that did it.
But getting back to the country home, many folks out there continue to work. They live in the bungalows, for example.
Yes, they do.
A lot of their income that they make then goes back to the home. Is that
yes.
How?
Some of them do. Some of them do.
I guess I wish you would comment on the motion picture home.
Well, I don't really know that much about it. You undoubtedly have been there more than I have. I don't think I've been there more than two or three times.
It's an incredible
yes, I'm told. I'm told that it is. I'm told that it is extremely well run, and they give them every opportunity to be able to have a diversified life out there. Now, what they make out of it, I don't know. You know, Grandma Moses, for instance. You know, I think she started painting when she was over 70 years old. But I think that was a latent talent. I don't think that was something that just all of a sudden happened. I think it was always there, but she never exposed it prior to that.
Do you go to movies at all?
Not very much, no.
Given that there's not rejuvenation, as you're saying, do you think the picture is at all a confused sort of message? I mean, in other words, what are we really saying to older people when we show them this scenario of rejuvenation when they're allowed to go off to wherever in a spaceship? I mean, I realize it's a fantasy, but it seems there should be some sort of, are we saying anything, or does the picture say anything, and if so, what?
Well, I personally look upon the thing as never lose hope, which I think is an imperative in older people, the same as it is in younger people. I just think that we're put here to make the most of what we've got. And I don't think that stops when you get to be 50 or 60 or 70 years old. I think it's too well demonstrated that people can. Now, part of it is genetics. you know, and there's nothing we can do about genetics. What we've got is what we're going to have to do with. But how many people, I believe there have been estimates made by people that make studies of this kind, psychiatrists, psychologists, that say that no one individual, I think that's probably exaggerated, comes anywhere near attaining 50% of what they're capable of doing.
So the message would not be that someone is going to come along and take care of you, but you just don't know what's going to happen.
No, what I feel the message is to keep your life in motion, no matter what age you get to be, to keep striving, to keep working toward whatever it is you want. Have a goal. Do the things. You know, it isn't easy to exercise 4 mornings a week or 5 mornings a week, which I do. It's difficult. But there are a lot of people my age that do that kind of thing and do it regularly. You know, it takes a little effort. Eric Fromm said in order to be able to fulfill yourself, there were 3 requisites: concentration, discipline, and patience. And I believe this with all my heart and soul. I think this goes for no matter what the age is. And I think it's just as imperative that these things be in place when you're 75 or 80 or 85, if genetically you're fit to do these things.
Yeah, but would you, Don Ameche, go into the spaceship?
No.
Why?
Because I don't believe in it, that kind of thing. I don't believe in an eternal youth, eternal life.
So you'd say in real life your character is perhaps more like, the Jack Guilford? You think this would be a cheating?
I don't think the character I play is that deep. I think he might go along with anything. Mm-hmm. He might just easily have gone along with it because of Gwen Verdon, because of the girl that he married. I don't think he was a responsible man ever in his life. This is what mm-hmm. I thought of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought he was a very selfish individual, lived only for himself, mm-hmm. and this is the way he wanted it, and it's what he did.
You can live to dance with Gwen Verdon, though. That's enough meaning in life.
Yeah, I mean.
Weren't you supposed to be representing a turnaround when you marry her?
To a degree, but how much of a turnaround is it?
I don't know. I thought there was some indication that you were doing some thinking.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. He made that decision. I think he made it. But will he live up to it? You know, how well he'd live up to it, I don't know.
Because eternity is a long time to be married.
Jean Cocteau did a play about it.
That's right.
The things that you're saying now, did you share any of these with Ron Howard?
No.
What kinds of conversations did you have?
No, I really didn't talk a whole lot about the character to Ron. When the writer and we had 2 weeks of rehearsal down there, and during that time I discussed it a great deal. It's more with the writer than I did with Ron, and the writer represented Ron because he wouldn't do anything that he thought Ron didn't want. So the character was very set. We all agreed as to what kind of person he was. I talked this out with Ron, yes, but after that, during the making of the picture, outside of the general instructions, you know, as tempos and characterizations, I don't believe we ever had any discrepancy of any kind about that. Tempo, this, that, and the other thing. But beyond that, I found Ron interesting to talk to, just to be around. He's a terribly shy man, extremely shy man. And I have a great deal of regard for him, a great deal of regard for his ability. I didn't get to know Ron at all.
But you're seeing what happened to him coming out of the theater last night. I don't know if any of you saw that. It's small wonder. On his way to the limo, it was just mobbed by kids yelling out, "Opie." Yelling it out in a rather nasty way, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, down in there weren't that many young people in St. Petersburg, but the ones that were there, he was the focus of attention wherever we were shooting, was Ron, and only Ron, actually. Scriptwriter and Ron, yes. Oh, always. Yes, I did.
What kind of a director was Ron?
Very good. Different. Totally different.
Of course, you've worked with some of the best.
Yes, I have. He wanted his way, and it has to be done his way, and this is fine by me, because I personally am one of the school that there's only one person that knows where a motion picture is going or what's going to happen to it, and that's the director. Nobody else can know it. And he didn't. He had his ideas were firm, and that's what he wanted, and I think that was just fine. It was easy for me. very easy for me. But some of them, I think, might have had some problems with it because they wanted a little more latitude. He was great in what words you wanted to use. You know, anything like that, you go ahead, change that. This he didn't care about. But you had to stay within the form of what he wanted.
Did he go into a scene knowing exactly what he wanted?
Yeah, very much so, very much so, very much so.
You were able to feel more comfortable with your lines because you could make small changes?
Oh, yes, I suppose, to a degree, although that's never, ever been a big problem to me. There are a lot of people that think that they can rewrite, you know, and give you a little idea about that. I made a picture called Heaven Can Wait with Ernst Lubitsch, and that's the top experience of my life in motion pictures, and I probably will never, ever come close to it again. He called everyone in the cast on the set the day we started shooting. Sam Rafelson did the script, and he said to the people, he said, when Sam and I finished writing this script, we then spent 8 months with a fine-tooth comb going over and bringing this up to what it is today. And he said, I beg you, don't change one word. This is the effort that he put into it, he and Sam, before they made the motion picture. And he knew exactly what he wanted. And he would not settle for anything other than what it was. Well, this is the easiest job in the world to me, because all I had to do at night was go to bed, memorize my lines, and then hope I could give him what he wanted the next day. This is easy motion picture making. Now, very easy.
Mary's going to let you talk about Lubitsch for the next half hour, right? Don't you dare take him away.
The Trading Places role, that was sort of like a last-minute thing, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I replaced someone.
Ray Milland, correct?
Ray Milland.
And it's easy for someone to want to bolt, you know, to just get scared or get angry, and then you got to figure out a way to work through that. So that can happen. That doesn't happen too often to me, but it does happen, and to every director. And you got to deal with that. But no, I'd say that I probably have more pure fun working with, you know, like maybe the Night Shift cast, where Henry was a great friend of mine, and Michael's this really loose, funny guy, and Shelley is great, and we're all basically the same age, and just all with something to gain by doing this, but no real high expectations, and just kind of just shooting from the hip. You know, I mean, that was a real loose set, and a lot of fun. This was a very, very difficult picture. This was not a fun movie to do. This was not a gas, you know. It was work. It was going to work every day. It wasn't painful, but it wasn't just cutting up and oh, it, by the way, we're making a movie. Isn't that interesting? You know. Yeah, it was a real chore, you know. And all of a sudden, we'd be going along and get some momentum, and then we'd have to do a couple of effects shots, and everything would kind of grind to a halt. And then suddenly, you know, you've just been working on some emotional scene, and now you're saying, okay, now you're looking at the alien. Well, where is the alien, Ron? Well, it'll be there someday. It's not there now. And then you get people, actors up, you get people, stand-ins and stuff on a ladder, just out of frame, so the people have somebody to look at, and some of the people like that, some of the people don't want to bother with that, you know. Also, there were a lot of diverse acting styles at work here, and I think that the that sort of my most important function was marrying those styles. Wilford is this improvisational wizard. He doesn't like to be burdened with having to do the script. You know, it feels a little put upon if you go in and say, we really need to say this. He'll do it, you know, but he likes it to be something new every take. A lot of the other cast members like things to be more rehearsed. Right. But Wilford was a great influence because I kept encouraging him, and then I would encourage the other actors to go toward that. And yet, in a lot of ways, Wilford's performance, I think, was fairly disciplined because he liked these actors, and he saw that he was throwing them a lot. And so he would come around and try to be a little bit more disciplined himself. I would love to see Wilford in his... And which is probably what they had on Stone Boy and Tender Mercies, you know, working with Duvall and everything, where that is the environment, you know. He's just, I like that, yeah. If the actor can really do it, it's always a little dangerous, but in my feeling is you need to try to get a good script. You don't want to completely rely on that, but I'm very happy to chuck the script. And then you can always, it's always there, you can always come back to it, and, you know, after three or four improvisational takes, you can say, well, I think we better try this line here. This is a good idea. Let's try to get that in there. And, you know, through editing, you can make all that stuff come together.
Before they take you away, directing the number of films that you've done now, has it ever enforced upon you a manner or an autocratic style that is against your own grain? To get it done right, have you ever had to go farther than you would?
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to toughen up a little bit once in a while, and I mean, I've had to replace people and things like that, and I think that's been probably good for me. Cheryl thinks that I'm a lot more assertive and also just outgoing, a lot less shy since I started directing. So, you know, I think it has been good for me. But I've become less autocratic. In my work, I think in the beginning, I felt that I had to really assert myself and sort of establish control. And now I don't feel that pressure anymore. And now I'd almost rather create a situation where people think, God, I don't know if he knows what he's doing. We better think about this, see if we can come up with something ourselves. And I've always got a plan and an idea that we can fall back on and that will probably work. But I like to see people be stimulated and come up with ideas that I haven't thought about and try them.
A romantic interest in that one. It was sort of like everyone's Skeet's in this movie. Let's get in here.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't know what happens, but when the lights go down in that editing room, boy, you never know what happens, you know? picture made $51 million. What am I going to argue? I don't know. It was different than the first one, and had different goals, but it was a very tough picture to make. It was a tough experience, so whatever came out of it, I think was good. I think that it was okay.
It was just very strange because, you know, you were the lead, you know, first build, but it was sort of like most of the action, you were more reacting.
Yeah.
Throughout the whole
thing.
It
was my job, and, you know, I think you have to realize that your job in certain pictures is going to be different each time. My job is... In Police Academy, one was different than the job in Police Academy 2,
yeah,
you know?
What I mean.
It was to set up different jokes. Mm-hmm. So when I wanted to go for certain character things, you know, I was like, Steve, come on. Okay. Let us tell you. Don't worry about the character and your thoughts about what's going to be this or that. Just set the joke up and leave. Okay, fine. So what I don't argue. I don't argue anymore with these, you know. Movie made more money than I can imagine, so. Yeah, I guess a lot of people got to know me from Diner in pictures, yeah, for sure. Absolutely, it was a ball. That was a very, very fun movie. The people were extraordinary. Now, I guess you can't touch Mickey Rourke and Kevin Bacon, but it was a... It was a great picture to do because we were all very, very hungry and really wanting to make it a great picture. Yeah. Yes. while everybody... Well, it's funny, because I remember when the studio saw it, they said, well, we wanted to make a movie about five guys. And the director said, yeah, but there's no car crashes, no sex, no monsters, no aliens.
But a lot of great sports trivia.
Yeah, but this movie's going to bomb. Shelve it. And they wanted to I remember they wanted to shelve Diner.
Sure.
And then I think they showed it to a few critics, and the critics wrote on their own about the picture, that it should be saved and it shouldn't be thrown away, and it was finally released, because it was going to be released by United Artists Classics, you know, like these little garage theaters that people have. And, you know, it would be sitting in someone's basement somewhere right now. Thank God it got out.
But when you do have a group of young actors like that, who are all, you've all had some experience. I mean, Kevin had done Off-Broadway and Friday the 13th. Let's not forget that.
Let's not.
And, you know, you'd done some things. Rourke had done some things. But you're all hungry, and you all can sense this may be it. There's a good side of it, but is there also the side of, well, wait a minute, I'm not getting as many close-ups as...
Well, yeah, but that happens on everything.
But particularly on something
that happens
like
on your paper, I'll bet.
Oh, I mean, yes,
sure.
All the time.
I mean, wait a minute. One, two, three, four, five. He got five goals! But that instills a certain competitiveness, and if the competitiveness is healthy, then the work is going to be better. Mm-hmm. So it's okay. There's nothing wrong with... You're on the same team, you're on the same track team, and in practice, you try to beat your partner around the track. He's on the same team, but you want to go for excellence. I believe in that. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't believe in cutting a guy off or tripping him. Mm-hmm. And I do believe also for standing on the side and rooting for your buddy who's doing it now. And that's there's a lot in that. So through that healthy competitiveness comes excellence.
I'm thinking of the track record that Ron Howard has with his young stars, for example, Shelley Long, Michael Keaton, Tom Hanks. Is this the sort
Tony
of thing?
Welch.
What am I going to say to this? Does this go through your mind when the whole idea of being in this picture first was broached to you?
No.
Not at all.
No. The first thing that I thought when I read this script was, boy, I really want to do this picture. I really love this. I'd like to see this movie. And when I want to see a movie, that means that, to me, translates in I'd love to be in it. If I can see it, I'd love to be in it. What happened to Michael and Tom and Shelley Long and those people, Daryl Hannah, I think is great. It's tremendous. But I'd be a fool. I'd be a fool to think that there's any correlation.
Of course, you're bringing to this
career
film a lot more advanced exposure than they have.
Well, but I don't, you know, sit back and go, well, now I want to be Michael Keaton because I don't want to be Michael Keaton, and I don't want to be Tom Hanks, and I don't want to be any of those people. I want to be myself, and I'm an actor, and I like what I do. So it's exciting, though, that he's created those stars.
I think you misunderstood the question. For them, for that association to produce such fruitful results, great public exposure, etc. Now, you've had some public exposure already, but being in a picture that Ron Howard has directed could have the kind of impact maybe on your career that is.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
We're on the screen a lot, and we're going to but a number of other people's roles were as well.
Sure. Am I?
I was just saying that would make a difference between those other movies.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the lead. But there's a part of Ron that is that comedy part that he loves to have fun with, and I think that Tom and Shelley and Michael fulfilled that in his pictures, and I hope that I fulfill that in this picture too, as well as those guys did.
Like when she leaves you on the deck of the boat after you first expressed your interest, and then you say, "Oh, I got things to do." That read to me. That's the kind of style that I guess I associate with Ron's work.
Yeah. What do you call that style?
Kind of touch.
What do you call it? Yeah.
The young guy says, "Oh, okay, I've got other things to do."
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Right. That everydayness somehow, that ordinariness is so special and so sweet and not sweet enough for you to go, "Ah, no way," but go, "Yeah, that's me." I think he builds a character into every picture that the audience can hook on to. Everyone in the audience can say, "That's me," in some way or another, and maybe that's what Jack is in this picture, is that young guy that a lot of the moviegoers, and hopefully we get all the moviegoers to go see that, of everybody, hook into maybe some of them, the young people or whatever, hook into me, and everyone else hooks into someone else. You know, I hope so. I was looking through I was looking right at a bright light, actually. Don Peterman was standing there, and I'm looking through, and there's just this little light, and then he turns on this light, and I go, ah! And that's exactly what I was looking for. But pardon? No, Ron's not like that, no. But what's great about these special effects in this picture is that I like the idea of not knowing what they were going to be, because I could use my imagination, and my imagination is always going to be better than really what's standing there, and then your acting is going to be maybe better. So I can, whatever it was in my mind. So it was all that, the lights and the glowing and all that stuff was just a ball to work with.
So the line about if this is foreplay, then I'm a dead man, did bring down the house.
It's a killer line, isn't it?
Have you seen it with other audiences?
I saw an audience on Wednesday night. How'd it do last night?
Very well.
Oh, yeah?
Did it do well? Oh, yes. That's good.
I mean, sometimes one line kind of stands out. You know, it's just, that's the one.
Well, that's great. That's great. I hope that everyone starts saying that. If this is foreplay, I'm a dead man. Be nice if that becomes the may the force be with you line. No, that was something that Ron and I came up with. We were coming up with different endings, and we had like 10. I love to do with the director, and Ron likes to do this, is do variations on a moment, because I think moments, a picture is made up of moments that you remember, the moment, and I think that you can take advantage of those moments by yelling them out, you know, and or emphasizing them somehow. And the emphasis on the ending was either to say nothing or some sort of line. And we had different lines of different things that happened in the picture. And this was something that we came up with. And I said, can we do it? And he said, yeah, go do it, because we've got lots of film. And we did it. And it's the one he kept. You know, I wouldn't have been surprised if he didn't keep it, because there was a lot of other ones that were good, too. But this one, it worked. I thought it would work. I had a feeling that would go. It would. Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the best kind of comedy, is when you know someone has certain fears, desires, wants. You know who he is, and when something happens, you can't wait to see this character react to it, because you know he's going to react in a certain way, and you're going to like the way he reacts. And Jack fulfilled those things.
Mm-hmm. As enthusiastic as you are right now, what were you like 2 hours ago? Are you always like...
2 hours ago? 2 hours ago? Oh, my girlfriend? No, she has, her wisdom teeth are coming in, so it was not fun a couple hours ago.
You are not tired. Look at this.
This is a hit movie. I mean, like, you know, you got to be an idiot to be tired. I mean... Look, if I was sitting here and it was a bomb, I'd be under the table right now. It's a great movie. Everybody likes it. I love it. This is my work. This is what I do for a living. This is what I do for my life. And it's working. So I'm happy as heck.
Hey, we've not seen that level of enthusiasm a lot.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. I can only speak for myself that I really... And I'm very, very appreciative of a good movie, and I'm very, very appreciative of being in one, because I know how rare that is, and how very often that does not happen. I'm sure in your circles, how rare does an article of yours get great attention? How rare? I mean, you write 80 articles, and maybe your editor will say, "Gee, I like two of them." You know? I mean, and that's your mine is when you say, "Gee, I like that movie," or you say, "They loved the movie the other night." That's my high. That's my editor saying to me, "You're gonna work next year." You know, that's my thing. So it's very exciting to be at
these. We appreciate
tables.
It too.
Your studio biography says that you slipped in your messenger. You slipped your own biography in.
Yeah, that's when I just started out. I was on Madison running up and down, delivering commercial pictures of kids doing commercials. And I was making $1.25 an hour. And I saw that these kids were making $250 a day. And I just, like, did not understand, you know. So I got a friend of mine to take some pictures of me and slipped them in and started doing auditions. And that's how I started. 16. Yeah. Yeah.
We were talking about with Brian Dennehy a little bit earlier about one of my favorite scenes in the film is near the end when you impulsively hug him and there's this fraction of a second delay. Like, is this how humans...
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Now, that's something he said that came out during the rehearsal period?
Yes, yes, it did. I think, and I know that it was his thoughts also with the when he was crying. He, like, said, oh, God, these are tears. Because inside him, that little being wasn't crying. I mean, was sad. But the beings, I mean, it's our movie. It's your movie, too, so it's whatever you think. It's my thought was, like, the being was sad inside this thing, you know, inside the body. And the feelings go through to the body. Now, when he hugged, when I went to hug, Jack, to me, was just saying, hey, this is great, you know, thanks a lot, goodbye. Goes give him a hug. And also it comes out of my relationship with Brian, too. I think that's what happens. A great my feeling on movies that I've liked and have done well have been relationship movies when you have a relationship with the actors, too. And I was saying goodbye to Brian. So I hugged him. And at the same time, I think his character was like, inside his little being was going, hey, goodbye, goodbye. And then like his outside being went, oh, I feel like doing that, too. And did that, so... Yeah, I think that part hits a lot of people more than I thought it would. I never really thought. I just, you know, I hug them and did the thing, and then a lot of people talked about it.
Did you? Now you had like a 2-week rehearsal period?
We had a 2-week rehearsal period. Yeah. Yeah, we did. Then there was a lot, but there was a longer period before that because I had the role for like a 6 weeks before we shot, or 2 months before we shot. So. Well, I considered that a rehearsal period, too, for myself.
But, I mean, what sort of kinks were you able to get out, you think?
Oh, gosh, well, tons. I mean, the way I work is I come up with about 90 ideas, 60 to 90 ideas on loosely, and I sit down with my director when I can get him, you know, when he's not doing this and that, and I go through ideas. What are his fears, his desires? What does he like to wear? Does he shave? Does he use underarm deodorant? Does he have any pets? What type?